Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is once again your navigator, John Lash, recording in the early hours of Sunday, February 10, 2013. This is NAB Briefing 46, entitled Matangi Moments, continued, that is to say, the follow-up of MB-45. I'm still here on my night vigil, awaiting the last moment of the Matangi shift, which ends today. I won't be able to see the sunrise crescent. It's too small. Generally, you can't see it on the last day of the shift, but only the next to the last day. So I resorted to stellarium.org. And what did I find there? Well, what you can all find if you call up this day and look at the eastern horizon at dawn. Venus stands in the body of the constellation of the goatfish, and the sunrise crescent will therefore be conjuncting Venus just a few hours before the sun appears. So both Venus and the crescent moon will be lost in the aura of the rising sun. Nevertheless, there it is. You can picture it. You can always imagine what is happening in the sky, even if you cannot observe it. Let me say again what I stated at the beginning of this experiment, and it's worth repeating. In planetary tantra in general, and specifically in the GNE, you have the opportunity to train your faculties and to actually advance with the use of your faculties, your goddess-endowed faculties, to advance into feats of shamanic detection and to advance into heightened states of awareness. So you use observation, which belongs to the first attention, and you use imagination or visualization, which belongs to the second attention. Note that the function of the second attention, which is imaginative, or what we call the dreaming attention, has primarily two modes. It has three, actually. Actually, it has five, but I'll describe three of them. The modalities of the dreaming attention are its visual modality, one. So that is to say, when you look at the composite of stars around Jupiter right now, you see the star off to the right of Jupiter and lower, and you say that is the eye of the bull, you're adding a visualization to your observation. Actually, all that you observe are some stars in a pattern that strikes the eye due to the positioning and the brightness of those stars. When you say that is the eye of the bull, those are the horns of the bull, Jupiter stands in the forehead of the bull, you're adding a visualization. That is the first modality of the dreaming attention, to visualize. Second modality is narrative. When you add a storyline to what you imagine, then you have a narrative trajectory, and you build on that narrative trajectory. The master schema, if you will, the master framework for using the power of the dreaming attention in its narrative modality is, of course, the Sophia Mythos, the sacred narrative of the mysteries. When you look at the constellations with the first modality and you visualize the twins, the bull, the crab, you add to that the second modality of narrative content by considering the mythological connotations of those celestial images, as well as by considering their correlations in the Shakti cluster. You know, for instance, that Bhudevi and the Rathal Green Tara are correlated to the constellation of the bull. Then you have in those figures a narrative component. That's the second modality. Third modality of the dreaming attention is your kinetic or motor abilities. This is generally expressed in traditional cultures around the world and indigenous cultures through the power of trance dance. Through trance dance, for instance, in the first learning, in the earliest learning experiences of the human animal, through trance dance, hunters learned to tell the story of the hunt. They remembered the story of the hunt, and they retold it around the campfire. They gave the members of the tribal community visual pictures of the hunt. They described the animals visually. They gave them a narration of tracking and killing the prey, and a narration of returning to the camp with the prey. And they often did that using gestures and ritual acts. The power of this simple ritual commemoration, if you will, was so immense that our species developed it into the ritual of war of hunting party dancing, excuse me, the ritual of dancing in the hunting party. The most well-known example of this, of course, or the first one, one of the first ones that comes to mind, would be the cliche of Native American Indians, such as Apaches or Cherokees, dancing around a fire at night in preparation for undertaking the buffalo hunt the next day. In doing the dance, the ritual dance, they not only use a mimetic magic that calls forth the spirit of the prey and gives reverence to the animal to be hunted, but they actually prepare themselves as warriors and hunters. They actually gear their NLP and their instincts and their very senses to the procedures of the hunt that they will undertake on the following day. So by dancing around the fire, imitating the buffalo hunt and even imitating the buffalo itself, they are actually doing something that is supernatural and extremely practical at the same time. It is what they call in military terms operational procedure, operational readiness for a mission to be undertaken. And this is one of the very, very most ancient and archaic ways in which our species has used and implemented the dreaming power of the second attention. I provide that little anecdote, which you might store in your mind, in the event that in the future it becomes appropriate, the moment comes when it is appropriate to use a similar techniques to prepare the Calico War Party to engage the enemies of the Anthropos and of all animal species and of the earth itself. As it was then, so it shall be again. I'm pretty certain of that. And I'm pretty certain that you are also certain of that. So in proceeding with this follow-up talk to MB45, let me just conclude my remarks on this mysterious matter of phylogenetic memory and the dredging devices of the lunar nodes, the mechanism of memory of the wisdom goddess herself. To a great extent, the advantage of the predators on this planet, the advantage of the faction of human animals who have for a number of centuries now been dedicated to the destruction of the rest of the human species, to its enslavement and or destruction. They have relied strongly on the failure of continuity in human historical memory. There has been, since the time of the mysteries, since the time of the destruction of the mystery schools, there has been a massive concerted attempt to deprive the human family in general, the human tribe, of the true memory of its own history. And we all, every one of us today, suffers from this intentional and deliberate act of oblivion or imposed amnesia, as you might call it that. For instance, every human being on this on the planet today stands in front of the three pyramids on the Giza plateau in a state of complete bafflement. We in fact do not remember phylogenetically how we constructed those pyramids, nor do we have the records, even though certainly records existed. So the records that would tell us how and why those monuments were constructed have been destroyed. Since the time of the murder of Hypatia in 415 AD, a massive amount of records have been either destroyed or secreted in places such as the Vatican Library, where they are not accessible to anyone who wants them. In fact, they are exclusively accessible to those who wish to control and enslave the human species for their own particular sinister and insane agenda. So you can see that continuity is a serious problem for the human animal, and it's an even more serious problem for the wisdom goddess. However, it is my observation that since a particular date in particular moment in the year 2012, this problem is now rapidly unraveling. And what would that moment be? Well, it's not difficult to determine. You know, things may get complex. Things may get complicated in the GNE from time to time. The practice of this experiment does require keeping track of some rather vast and massive events taking place. But the tracking process is based, I assure you, the tracking process that I use is based on simple and fundamental astronomical facts. So I would have you cast your mind back to March of 2011, the inception moment of the three initial years of correction. Where was the north node of the moon at that time? Well, lo and behold, my friends, it was moving right exactly into conjunction with a galactic center. North node of the moon, March 2011, was verging directly into the 27th degree of the sign Sagittarius, which is above, marks a point in the ecliptic, above the stinger of the scorpion's tail, directly in front of the arrow in the constellation of the Archer. And as you all know by now, the Archer's aim and the position of the arrow aligned to the stinger locates the galactic center, and that's where the north node of the moon was when correction began. Now, if you come ahead to the first week of September, by the way, I would just add, that is a pleromic connection. That is a galactic connection. Once every 18 and a half years, the north node of the moon conjuncts the sight line to the galactic center. That's a galactic connection. Now come ahead to the first week of September 2012. At that moment, when the lunar apogee, which is shifting from fishes to ram and to bull, reaches the Pleiades. Remember, the Pleiades is on the border of the constellation of the bull, and it corresponds in the sign framework to 1 degree of Gemini. Come forward, following the shift of the apogee. You have to visualize it because the apogee is not observable. following the shift of the apogee before the satanic face of Cetus, and then bingo, it conjuncts the Pleiades, indicating the completion of pleromic relay. Now, where was the north node of the moon at that time? It had advanced to 1 degree of Sagittarius, which is actually in the head of the scorpion. But where was the south node of the moon? Well, the south node is opposite the north node, isn't it? And the south node of the moon at that moment was in 1 degree of Gemini. In other words, the south node of the moon reached the Pleiades at the same moment as did the apogee of the moon. Now, this is just something that you can observe. It's factual. It's simple. It's not that complicated. If you know that the lunar nodes move regularly backward, that is to say, precessing against the natural order of the zodiac at a rate of about, where do I have it here in my old book, about 19 or 20 degrees per year, then you can follow the rotation of the lunar nodes. And if you know that the lunar apogee moves forward more or less steadily, but with certain moments of stall and a slight fallback over a period of 8.6 years, you can follow that through the zodiac. But just imagine the statistical probability that the two of them would converge at the Pleiades at that particular point. Just try to conceive of the statistical probability of that. I assure you that the odds are very, very, very high or low. I never know what to say. Are the odds high if it's like 10 million to 1? Is that high or low odds? Anyway, that's about what you're looking at. Just consider, as I do, and do it for your delight and for your enlightenment. Just consider how the simple and calculable astronomical components of this experiment come together like that. Just give it a moment and consider that. And how they come together and perfectly match the experience that you are developing in your own life using your imaginative power. And I assure you that when I say that directive mythology is the practice of living myth in real life terms, I know exactly what I'm talking about. And I demonstrate it by the way that I live, by the way the NAV lives, and you as well demonstrate it by your participation in this fantastic experiment and in planetary tantra. So I say congratulations to all of us when such astonishing details in the granular development of this experiment can be noted. I say bravo. How voracious is this? And how exciting it is to have the confirmation that the powers of imagination of the human animal indeed do work in this way, and that they are indeed interactive with the earth and with the entire starry cosmos. And you can't touch that. There's nothing else going that gives you that. Nothing else that delivers such a result on this planet apart from the tantra of the planet. And that's what the Turton means when he says interactive magic with Gaia. So, my friends, here I am in the follow-up talk on Matangi moments. And let's see if I can focus on some of the objectives now coming into definition for the Kalika War Party. One thing I ask you to to accept is that if you're in the GNE from this point on, then you're in the Calico War Party. You may just be a supporting member of the party, or you may be an operative, but you have to be in the party to be in the GNE. And to ease your concern about that, if you do have any concerns, just let me say something I haven't said before. Let me put an important proposition into clear and succinct terms. The objective of the Calico War Party, the general objective, is to conduct psychological warfare against the enemies of the Anthropos, period. Now, it's almost a truism, and has been for some time now, that psychological warfare, somebody, let's say, I shall not use the passive voice, I shall not say psychological warfare is being conducted, that's the passive voice. Somebody, exactly who to be determined, somebody who is hiding and using deceitful means and remaining in many respects outside detection, somebody is conducting psychological warfare on human animals on this planet. It is the conclusion of many investigators, courageous and diligent people who are not being paid for what they do, truth seekers, call them truthers, I call them truth seekers. It is the conclusion of these people, after having studied our world in these 10, 12 years since 9/11, particularly, with particular intensity, it is their conclusion that there is a war going on for your mind and in your mind. But when this point is made, and these truth seekers make it over and over again, it seems to me that they're leaving out an essential truth, which is not the truth that they would be seeking about what happens in the world, but the truth regarding what they can do about what happens. And I'm here to tell you that of the numerous hats I wear, which is author, teacher, navigator, Churton, I stand now first and foremost at the head of the male band of the Calico Warrior Party. And I'm here to tell you that I deliver a message that no other truth seeker on this planet is delivering so far. And that is, yes, there is a war on for your mind, but there is also war to be conducted with your mind. And that is the general objective of the Calico Warrior Party. So if you wish to consider yourself in the party, then consider if you would be willing, ready, willing, and able to undertake certain acts of psychological and psychic war directed toward the enemies of the planet. And then you can be in the party. You do not have to step into the ranks of warriors who are preparing to exercise the lethal strike. So, that being said, I'm happy to inform you all that this trinity of women, foreguard action of the three infernal witches, Kali central, Matangi on the right flank, and Kurukula on the left flank, is just about the best thing that I've seen in my lifetime. We've had some fantastic successes in the GNE, the anchor, pleromic relay mainly, other really fabulous moments of revelation and learning, fabulous moments of deepening intimacy and commitment to the planetary animal mother. But I have to tell you that being in the avant-garde of the Calico Warrior Party and standing behind these three infernal witches, these warrior witches, is a great, great, great pleasure. And I am so happy to be there. I remind you that the Sandy Hook event, whatever it was, occurred on the 14th of December 2012, the first day of the Kurukula shift. Coming through the Kurukula shift into 2013, there was an apparent skip of Mahakali, this being the next Dakini normally in the sequence, and a jump on January 12th to Matangi. But as I pointed out, these three are always together now. And just as Kali was behind Kurukula in her shift, Kali stands with Matangi in this shift, and these three continue to be the on the front line of this psychic battle. I think it is something extraordinary and remarkable to be noted with great attention that these three warrior witches, as I call them, come to be introduced to human imagination at the moment of the Sandy Hook event. So I'm going to talk more about this event now, pick up some of the observations that I made about Matangi's knife and the use of that knife and the questions presented in Matangi instruction that show you how to use her knife, and make some more observations about what's happening in the world today that reflects the moment of engagement in this psychic and psychological battle. It's not just a battle for the narrative, that becomes more and more obvious as we go along. Whoever controls the narrative controls events to their advantage. So there is a battle for the narrative to be considered. I have a lot to say about that, and I'm receiving much guidance on that point. But it's also a battle, a real battle, for the safety and security and happiness and freedom of every living creature on this planet. I can't think of anything more worth living for or dying for. And since you're going to die anyway, how about that choice? Now, I've entitled these briefings Matangi Moments. And this is an attractive term, I think. I like it. And I like to use it to remind myself of what's really going on here. What are Matangi Moments? You're having them. I'm having them. People who have no idea whatsoever that planetary tantra exists or that the Gaian navigation experiment is underway are also having them. Matangi moments are those moments when you stop and question what you are being shown, and even more so, what you are not being shown. You question what is not there. Now, as I said, when I received the knife from Matangi, you can visualize the knife in its sheath, suspended in the air, in front of you, a little above, about a foot above your level of sight. When I received that, I also received the question attached to the sheath. If you want to hold the knife by its sheath, that's how you receive it. Actually, grasping the blade, but the blade is protected, your hand is protected from the blade, then you ask this question: where is the network and affiliate footage of the motorcade on the day that JFK was murdered? Where is it? That is a Matangi moment, even though it refers back to an event going on almost 50 years now. Because at that, with that question, your attention goes fully to that which is not seen. That which is not seen. And as I pointed out, although some people claim to have seen the Zapruder film without the frames removed, everyone else in the world, and you can take it or leave it if you believe that story, everyone else in the world has seen the Zapruder film with the initial frames removed so that it does not show the motorcade making the left turn into Dealey Plaza, which was the first kill zone. The whole plaza was a kill zone, but that was the first kill zone. By some accounts, there were three bands of assassins set up to make sure that this got done in case the first one missed. And there was some trouble with the first action in the kill zone on the curve, and those frames were removed from the Zapruder film. But studies such as the Intrepid study of Jack White shows you that certain clues in the remaining frames point to the fact that something odd happened on the curve. And also it's inexplicable why Zapruder would stop filming when the motorcade came around the curve. But what's even more inexplicable is, given that there was network and affiliate coverage of the president's visit to Dallas, which was a very controversial visit, by the way, a lot of people didn't want him there, and there were even posters put up in Dallas saying that showing him in a profile and side photo saying wanted for treason, because there was an extreme right-wing militant element in Dallas that considered that some of Kennedy's choices, such as ending the Vietnam War, were treasonous to their business. But anyway, not to digress, what is even more astounding is that given the presence of network and affiliate film teams that day in the morning breakfast talk on the way to the other venue at the airport, you mean to say that there were no such camera teams in Dealey Plaza? But who has ever even heard anyone question whether there were or not? I haven't. As far as I know, excuse me, but I'm among the first, must certainly be among the first people who's ever raised the question of where was that professional footage of the motorcade. And if there were no professional teams there that day, at that particular locale, then why weren't they there? So this is a Matangi moment. We can't go back and redo history, and we can't even reconstruct in every detail the events of that day. And many of the witnesses are dead by now, people who were present. But nonetheless, the power of the Matangi eye comes to you by asking that question, and just ask it over and over again. It's like a tuning device to bring you into the power of the Matangi eye, which is a bullshit detector, and which is the eye that allows you to see what you are not being shown. Then you can fast forward to 9/11, you can apply the Matangi eye to that. This was a highly advanced PSYOP or mindfuck operation constructed, I mean, compared to the Kennedy assassination, which was really, as many people say, like a mafia hit. It was just a mafia hit that got filmed, okay? 9/11 was a snuff film, a mass snuff film involving events in which people really did die. But it was set up in such a way that what you see in the 9/11 event is actually what is not there. You are seeing what is not there. And I refer to the film footage that shows airplanes crashing into the Twin Towers. There were no airplanes crashing into the Twin Towers. But the construction of that psyops makes it look as if there were. A good factor, one of the great things about the Matangi Eye is that when you have the Matangi Eye, as some people did on that day, some people knew on the day it was happening that it was somehow an act of fakery, of technology. When you have the Matangi Eye, it allows you to apply your common sense to a situation and to very rapidly come to terms with the situation. For instance, if you had the Matangi Eye watching that photography, those photographic images of a plane slamming into the building, combined with common sense, then you would have said, it's impossible for an airplane to slice into a building of steel and reinforced, steel-reinforced concrete as if it were a hot knife slicing through butter. It's physically impossible, defies the laws of physics. Do you know how you have the Wile E. Coyote cutout, as Dr. Judy Wood calls it? The Wile E. Coyote cutout of the plane? Even down to the wingtips? Oh, sure. Sure. Do you know that on the... Everyone knows because you've seen it at the airport. It's written on the wings of airplanes, out at the tips, and sometimes in closer to the body, no step. Why is that written? It's because if people who are working on the jetliner step on that part of the wing, they can damage it. And that especially applies out at the tip end of the wing. So do you suppose that it is consistent with the law of physics that an airplane wing that is so fragile that if it has human weight on it, it could be damaged, is going to leave its imprint in a steel-reinforced building? So the Matangi Eye shows you, in fact, what you're not seeing. The Matangi Eye, looking at that famous footage, says, you're not seeing an actual passenger airplane hit this building. And common sense confirms that, because the results of such an event, were it to have occurred, would have been absolutely visually and physically different. So you can see that in the 9/11 event, the tremendous physical impact, the tremendous force of murder and mayhem, the destruction of the lives of thousands of people, and seven buildings, by the way, seven buildings were destroyed on the site of the World Trade Center. All of that physical destruction and murder and mayhem is packaged tightly with a psyop process of mental and perceptual distortion and deception. So the mental deception, the act of mental deception that destroys and that attacks the human mind goes along with the act of physical destruction, and they are one and the same act. And with, if you can analyze this and see it as I do with the Matangi Eye, where you can then see the beginning of detecting the operations of deceit, of massive archontic deceit, which are in the arsenal of the enemies of humanity. Now, fast forward again to Sandy Hook, and I'll talk about Sandy Hook for the remainder of this briefing. With Sandy Hook, the sophistication of the psyop is even more advanced. It's even more advanced than 9/11. In the first place, well, Sandy Hook demonstrates a number of advances in mindfuck technique used by the planetary predators. Let's see if I can briefly point out what they are. In the first place, the Sandy Hook psyop requires and uses no holographic or archontic fakery. Now, it has generally been said that the known technology of the military in weapons technology and mind control technology, the known technology, is 30 to 50 years behind the actual technology they possess. If you don't think that the American military or whoever controls them is in possession of holographic technology and CGI technology that could create the image of an airplane when it's not there, then you're not keeping up with the game. They do that in amusement parks in Japan with Godzilla. Do you think that they can't do that 100 times better with military weapons? And so the fakery, the photographic fakery of 9/11 was pretty impressive and does prove that this technology exists, which represents a deep incursion into the human powers of perception. You know, I started out by saying that photography, when it portrays a faked image rather than an exact photographic replica, say, for example, an exact photographic replica of a rare butterfly, when it conveys a fake image, for instance, butterflies flying around a box of dishwashing detergent to suggest to you that it's as fresh as the spring air, when that kind of fakery occurs in the content of photography, that it allows the archonic powers who are staring us down constantly, staring down the anthropos from their extraterrestrial outposts, it allows them to put pinpoint blind spots in your field of perception. And as these pinpoint blind spots merge eventually, they produce maculae. That's the plural of macula, M-A-C-U-L-A, which means massive blind spots in the field of human perception. And given the advantage provided by these blind spots, certain human predators can use the technology of perceptual manipulation, as we saw at 9/11. But look at Sandy Hook. Didn't even bother with it. What they're showing at Sandy Hook, they're showing their hand in many ways, whoever they are. They're showing their hand by the way this PSYOP is constructed. But in the first place, they're saying, we don't even need to use all of that expensive and elaborative manipulation of perception that is evident in the 9/11 events. This is like just a homegrown, simple, hometown, down-to-earth little event. Of course, it has attached to it the horror of the murder of children, and that is an important motif. I'll come back to that at the end of this talk. The dimension and the dimension and execution of the Sandy Hook PSYOP is certainly different from the 9/11 PSYOP. But there is one significant parallel. And again, it's the Matangi eye that shows you how to see this parallel. In the 9/11 event, you are shown what is not there. Okay? Got that? Airplanes hitting the Twin Towers. You are shown what is not actually there. In the Sandy Hook event, you are not shown what is not there. That's an even deeper incursion into your mind. That's an even deeper assault to create, to engender cognitive dissonance, confusion, and most of all, and I believe this is the primary objective of the Sandy Hook PSYOP, to totally undermine the confidence of your own perception and your ability to judge what you perceive. People are still debating what they saw on 9/11. The witnesses presented by the media told of seeing planes, but some of the witnesses presented by the media said that they weren't planes. And as a matter of fact, My research indicates that a great many people on the ground at that time, that is to say, 50 that of known testimony, and perhaps quite a few more, said that there were no planes, and they were there. They said that there were either no plane at all, or that there was something that was a flying projectile, but it wasn't what it was supposed to be. But in the case of that debate, please note that the parties on all sides are debating about evidence, visual evidence, that was shown. Now advance to Sandy Hook. Debate is about visual evidence that was not shown. You're not shown what was not shown. Whereas with 9/11, you're shown what was not shown. You get the difference. Sharpen your mind on that difference. Sandy Hook, from the very first moment, there is a narrative. Remember that the dreaming attention works with visualization, we can say visual evidence, and a spoken narrative. It has the visual and the oral. It has the picture content and the narrative or spoken content. Sandy Hook starts out within minutes of the event, which apparently began at 8:40 a.m. on that Friday school day, with a narrative. Now, first of all, where does this narrative come from? Here's the narrative. An incident is occurring at a school. A lone gunman has entered the school and has apparently, acting alone, massacred 20 children and 7 adults in the school. This is a narrative. The narrative was put into the collective consciousness through news media, both local and national news media in the United States, and then world news media, wasn't it? Okay, passive voice, but we'll get by on that. And the question is, well, where did this narrative come from? If you look at the Sandy Hook footage, and I've looked at quite a bit of it, I don't think there is any shot of a police official on the scene at the time stating this narrative, which is unusual. The narrative goes from some unknown source, presumably the first responders and the police who are on the site, on the scene, directly to the media, and then comes from the media reporters to the world at large. But the media does not present any single interview with the sources of the narrative. So again, even at the narrative level, the key to the Sandy Hook event is that you are not shown what you are not shown. Then again, let's look at the visual evidence, photographic evidence, CC camera footage of the break-in, CC camera footage of the chaos in the hallways and in the classrooms, photographic evidence of the murdered children. I'd love to see that. A lot of people would. Just graphic photographs of them. Or photographic evidence of the damage done to the rooms, and photographic evidence of the shells, photographic evidence of the body of the shooter and of the guns that are found with the shooter. Remember, what Tongi teaches through the observation of the technology of photography and film and how it is used and manipulated. And you can always go back and study this phenomena through the last 150 so years when photography was discovered, and draw lessons that help sharpen the Matangi eye. So, people have observed, and this is the outstanding observation regarding Sandy Hook, that the reporting entities release their narrative to the world without one single piece of photographic corroboration. There is no photographic evidence of any kind that the described events actually occurred. Now, is this intentional? You bet your life this is intentional. But this is part of the intentional structure of the PSYOP. There is a monumental bravado and arrogance to be seen in the way this event was orchestrated and executed. It's as if the people who pulled off this event are saying to the world, "You suckers and you fools, we are so adept at what we are doing, and we are so secure in our ability to deceive you and manipulate your minds, that we're going to let you know from the first moment that we're not allowing you to see any of the physical evidence of this event. And we're going to do that to upset you and confuse you." And ha ha, hee hee, guess what? It may well be that the physical evidence of the event that you demand doesn't even exist. So the signature, the hallmark of the Sandy Hook event is the withholding of evidence that doesn't exist. Now, when you go back to the Kennedy assassination, it's a totally different game. That was a much earlier stage, and it was more or less an unsophisticated mafia-type kill, a mafia hit, that was then covered up by a lot of murder and blackmail and deceit and lies. But and that event, the assassination of Kennedy, was intended to produce a massive psychological impact and to inflict massive psychological, emotional, and moral damage to the entire world, and it indeed did so. But you do not find in the Kennedy assassination event and in the orchestration of that event this kind of advanced sophistication of psychological warfare. The perpetrators of the Sandy Hook event are flagrantly showing that they can manipulate the human mind not merely by an absolutely ridiculous and unverifiable cover story, but also by withholding evidence that isn't even there in the first place. And so, what happens? And this is also something that the perpetrators anticipated, is that someone stands up, mainly this professor in Florida, I think, and says, well, many people do, but he broke into the mainstream news with the declaration, well, it's possible that nothing actually happened here at all, according that follows the official story. It's possible that there could have been no children or adults murdered. It's natural and normal for a human animal to propose that possibility. Why? Because there is no evidence that what the narrative states actually occurred. Now, I don't take the position that children and adults were not murdered on that day, and I don't claim that they were. I just don't know, along with the rest of you. I don't know if they were or not. But I would suggest this terminology. Let's call the Sandy Hook event, the Sandy Hook massacre, a hollow event. This is a term I introduce in the language of psychological warfare. What is a hollow event? It is an event that is faked in such a way that the actual event doesn't even have to happen. It's not faked in a way that 9/11 was faked, where there were people murdered and real damage to buildings in New York City and some kind of damage in the field in Pennsylvania and certainly massive damage and murder of people and disappearance of records at the Pentagon. Those were concrete elements of the event around which was built an intentionally unbelievable cover story, and all of that wrapped up into the PSYOP, into the structure of the PSYOP. But here, the Sandy Hook massacre is a hollow event. There doesn't even have to be any murder. There doesn't even have to be any actual physical damage in order for the event to produce its intended effect. I call that a hollow event. And the fact that the perpetrators have now advanced to using a hollow event reveals, to my mind, their arrogance and chutzpah, if you will, to use a quaint Jewish term, is absolutely going over the top. This event shows that they are really confident that they can bring down the entire human species into enslavement and annihilation with their code of deceit. By deceit, by deception, we shall conquer. And they have conquered the minds of a great many of human animals on this planet. Sandy Hook is an example of a moment when the perps don't need, really, to kill anyone or to produce any physical mayhem. There is no evidence of physical mayhem or murder if no such event actually occurred. And obviously, so far anyway, but the game's not up yet, because more information is to be released when the sealing of the investigation expires in a couple of months. You can expect that to be the second part or follow-up of this PSYOP. But up until now, the perps have actually been acting, ironically, in complete honesty. They haven't presented any CC footage or any photographic evidence of the massacre because there was no massacre. Also, the preposterousness of the official storyline even exceeds the preposterous and illogical and absurd elements of the 9/11 cover story. You know, the passport found in the ruins, they know the names of all the hijackers within 3 hours. It's got Osama bin Laden's MO all over it. All this kind of stuff that was fed to the world in the first day of the event. They, in the Sandy Hook event, are even doing better at feeding a narrative that is completely preposterous. A 20-year-old, 120-pound kid with an autistic-like disorder covers his body with weapons and ammunition equivalent to half or more of his body weight, breaks into a school, and pulls off dozens and dozens, some say hundreds of rounds, shooting some of these children as much as 11 times. Children squirm around a lot, you know, and they hide, and they're not easy targets. Does all this in a matter of 5 minutes, loading, reloading his clips and so forth. You believe that? Do you believe that this Adam Lanza, who doesn't even appear to exist, or has certainly disappeared into oblivion over the last 3 years, could physically pull off such a feat? It is not intended to be believed. It is intended to be disbelieved and to question and questioned. But on that point, we come to the final observation I want to make in this briefing right now about the Sandy Hook PSYOP. I submit to you that this PSYOP has a particular character which makes it different from anything preceding, and that is why there is a lack, that is why it could have been and may well have been perpetrated without actual murders being committed. Why? Because the nature of this PSYOP, the structure and operation of the PSYOP, works its effect in the exposé of the event. In the exposé. Now let me explain what I mean by that. One thing you can be sure of is that the perps who execute these kind of events are extremely clever. They are diabolically clever, in fact, and you got to hand it to them. You got to hand it to them that they are really good at what they do. Respect your enemy in that sense. One of the things that they know, and they knew it already at 9/11, is that there will be, when they pull off an event, there will always be a considerable number of human beings who won't buy the cover story, won't buy the narrative that they release with the event, and who will attempt to deconstruct the event and criticize the narrative and get to the truth of what happened. They know that there are truth seekers out there who will dedicate their entire life to trying to see what was actually done, to trying to solve the crime of 9/11. I won't call them truthers, I'll call them truth seekers. So they already anticipate that there is going to be a concerted effort by certain dedicated individuals to attack the narrative, the official narrative, to try to see the actual facts and to get through the veil of perception and see what actually happened and who did it. And so they set up the event anticipating that. How did that work in the case of 9/11? Well, it's an example of what is called controlled opposition. As the so-called truther movement emerged, the 9/11 truth movement, there were already in that movement operatives working for the people who committed the 9/11 crime. And that is called a controlled opposition. And in fact, someone commented recently, and I like this, that the Thermite theory is the conspiracy theory of the controlled opposition. It is not really the conspiracy theory about 9/11 that can explain the destruction of those buildings in New York City, but it is the conspiracy theory planted there to stand in the way of the true explanation. And the true explanation, as you know, I've said it before, the true explanation of the physical damage to the buildings on 9/11 comes uniquely from Dr. Judy Wood. So the thermite theory presented by Jones and the thermite theory endorsed by architects and engineers and so forth, is a plant of the controlled opposition. It's a clever way to make sure that the psyop of the event is not detected and that the effect of the psyop continues even among those who challenge the event and who attempt to crack the psyop. So a great many people over the last 12 years have fallen into this trap set by the perpetrators of 9/11, that they participate, some of them wittingly, and they're paid to do it, participate in maintaining the psyop by providing a conspiracy theory that is untrue, while others unwittingly fall into the misdirection and disinformation propagated in such conspiracy theories. Now, fast forward to Sandy Hook, it's even more spectacular. When you look at the bizarre anomalies that occur on the internet, even a few days before that event on December 14th, and then in the subsequent days, you might draw the same conclusion that I do, is that the main reason why the Sandy Hook event occurred was to insert an even deeper psyop into the truth seeker movement and to cause dissension and confusion in that movement, and also principally to cause truth seekers in that movement to look bad in the eyes of the general public. This is all intended and may in fact be the primary reason why the event occurred in the first place, to destroy the strength and integrity of the truth-seeking movement that has been building since the 9/11 event. So that is why I say that Sandy Hook is different from 9/11 in that it does not require the commission of physical mayhem and murder, because it is primarily and exclusively an act of psychological warfare and can function for its intended purpose without having physical destruction committed. Now, bear in mind that this event is not over and that the people who are perpetrating this event still have some cards up their sleeve. So, in the next month or two, when the results of the investigation, why is there an investigation if the shooter has been identified as a lone person who is dead? But the results of the investigation will be released. And who knows, maybe at that time, photographic evidence or CC camera footage will be released, which could well be fake. You know, the signature moment of this event, and this is a Matangi moment, is when the demented individual known as the coroner says, "Hey," and he's laughing, like the jokester, like the clown in the Batman films. "Hey, you can do anything with a good photographic team." So, if the perpetrators of this event want to present photographic evidence, they can fake anything they like. They can fake the CC footage of this young man breaking in. They might have already filmed him or somebody who looks like him in another setting breaking in with the same time signatures on the camera. They can pull this out and say this is irrefutable proof. So they have the option, after withholding the evidence that isn't there, they retain the option to present faked evidence if it's to their purposes. So be ready for that one, folks. See that one coming as the follow-up event and the second part of completing the Sandy Hook PSYOP. Finally, in winding up this talk and this NAB briefing, I'd like to offer for your consideration what I consider to be three telltale marks of this event that indicate the identity of the authors of this event, who is behind the Sandy Hook massacre that may or may not have actually been a physical massacre, but has the same effect whether or not it was physical, has the desired effect. Allow me to point out briefly three characteristics of this event, which to me are telltale signs of the MO of the perpetrators who designed, who planned and executed it. The first one is that the event is constructed to put truth seekers who question the narrative and who demand to see the physical evidence in a bad light and to make them look insensitive and even inhuman in regard to the horrible plight of the victims, that is, the families of the children murdered. You find in and around the debate about Sandy Hook the phrase, "sympathy for the victims, don't offend the victims. Don't investigate this, don't ask questions about what happened, don't ask to see photographs of murdered children. That is deeply offensive to the victims." Now, have you ever heard this song before? This, oh, we can't do that because it would offend the victims. Have you ever heard that song before? Who is known for playing that song? That's first sign of the fingerprints or the MO of the perpetrators. Second sign, closely related. Well, it was children that were killed. Now let's look at the progression. Theatergoers were killed in Aurora. Some college kids were killed on a campus somewhere. Some people in a Sikh temple were murdered. These are different, clearly defined different factions of the society, aren't they, of our society. Let's kill these people and create a big debate about who did it and what we should do to make sure it doesn't happen again. So let's kill people in a theater. Let's kill people in a Sikh temple. Let's kill people on a college campus. And wait. If we really need to get our point across, let's kill children between the age of 4 and 8. Now I ask you, is there any group of people on this planet, is there any faction of human beings living in any country in the world who are known for the flagrant liberty they take in murdering children? What is the, quote, massacre of the innocents theme doing in the Sandy Hook event? The massacre of the innocents theme, of course, is a biblical theme, isn't it? It goes back to the period, alleged period of Herod the Great, and it goes back to the story of Jesus and the New Testament, which in itself is an extension of the story of the Jews in the Old Testament. So there you have it. Consider that. Consider those two factors. The plea to not offend the victims, the survivors of the tragedy who lost their children, combined with the massacre of the innocents theme. That's the signature of the perpetrators. And to that I add the third factor. But the third factor, I must also emphasize, is deceptive and misleading. It does appear that the Sandy Hook event has now been incorporated into the huge debate going on in the United States, the huge struggle, that you could say, about disarmament of the population, the Second Amendment struggle. And so, some of the truth seekers, in fact most, who have tackled the Sandy Hook event, attempting to deconstruct it and to discern the objective of the event, have made this claim. This is obviously another false flag kind of event, deliberately staged in order to inflame public opinion toward disarmament, toward gun control. And here in closing, I want to make 2 points. First of all, I want to ask again, my first point is in the form of the question, who upon this planet, what nation or what people belonging to any particular nation or locality have made themselves known over the last few decades for the enjoyment and ferocity they exhibit in shooting unarmed people? Who likes to shoot unarmed and disarmed people? And who has demonstrated that they enjoy doing so and that they are convinced they can do so with absolute impunity, openly in the face of the global community? Who has shown that? That would be the third signature on the Sandy Hook event of the perpetrators. Having said that, however, I want to add this key observation. I personally am certain that inflaming the disarmament debate in favor of gun control was not the objective of the Sandy Hook PSYOP. No. The objective of the Sandy Hook PSYOP was, to be more precise, yes, to inflame that event, but not to actually lead to gun control. In the first place, I think any rational animal, especially if you're an American like myself, knows that the gun control debate can never be won, and that the American people, arms-bearing people, will not be disarmed. And so if you think that the Sandy Hook event was an extreme measure taken to push the debate in favor of gun control, I think you might be wrong. Because in fact, it might be worth considering, my friends, that the entire debate about the Second Amendment and the gun control controversy is a red herring and a massive snow job. It's a massive act of psychological warfare intended to keep people distracted from other things, and primarily to keep them distracted from the horrible truth, which is that when push comes to shove and the perpetrators of 9/11 make their final move on America, it ain't going to matter much what kind of gun you're carrying, because it's going to be a move enforced by weaponry that goes beyond hand-to-hand gun battles. And so to think that the Second Amendment controversy and the fight over gun control is decisive to the fate of America is wrong and misleading. But the perpetrators of 9/11 and Sandy Hook would love you to believe that, and they would love people to wear themselves out on this debate. And so, while actual disarmament of the American people is not the objective of this PSYOP, the inflaming of the controversy over disarmament is. Because one of the techniques of the perpetrators is to divide people and get them to fight among themselves. The brutal truth is that no matter what side of the gun control argument you stand on in the United States of America, when the enemies of America who wish to destroy that country, which is the country that I was born, when the foreign state who controls the American military wishes to destroy that country in a final move and reduce it to something like a cross between a Soviet gulag and a Palestinian death camp, the weapons they intend to use will make being armed or disarmed totally irrelevant. So, even though I maintain it is probably the dearest wish of those people to disarm the American public, because they much prefer to kill disarmed people, as they have shown but through decades, but they'd much prefer that, and it would be a lovely victory to celebrate using their shills in the American Congress. But they don't need to. They don't really need to. And the disarmament debate serves better as a smokescreen than it does as a procedure leading to actual disarmament. And if that doesn't show you how sick and devious these perpetrators are, then I don't know what will. And if that doesn't show you the depths and scope of their hatred for the United States, then you need to look more closely, and you need to apply the Matangi eye. I can tell you that the enemies of this planet hate the United States with a particular ferocity. And as an American, I take that hatred on their part very seriously. My apologies for sounding a bit heavy-handed here, but needless to say, it's a heavy subject. And on that note, I conclude this NAV briefing.